Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software, or are interested in finding a great place to work, please do check out their links in the description below.
Can you introduce yourselves a little bit and the software factory and what it is that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, sure. I'll go first and I'll throw it to Jeff. I think everybody has, you know, a slightly different perception based on where they sit in the org. But our mission at the Army Software Factory is to prototype a future force design for the Army. So we fall under Army Futures Command. And Army Futures Command is kind of tasked with looking out to what the Army is going to need in the coming 10, 20 year period. So a force design means like what is the Army lacking? And in this case, the Army's software factory's hypothesis was we don't have software, like a software development talent or capability in the service. The uniformed soldiers, they have a lot of different IT functions that are covered, and cybersecurity functions, but software development really wasn't one of them. And that was something missing. So the Army Software Factory said, we can do the research, but really in order to tell you what this should look like, we need to run the experiment. So we started off the software factory and we train soldiers, to become developers, and we build software to solve Army problems. But both of those are kind of ancillary benefits that the Army gets. And the main thing that they get from us is us telling them what a career field, what a software development capability would look like in the force.
Right. And could you just introduce yourself as well and your role?
Yeah. So I'm Matt Flott. I'm the CTO for the Army Software Factory. I spent 20 years in the Army. I was a warrant officer, which is kind of a technical field or technical rank, and I was an IT focus. So I ran like servers and that kind of stuff for the Army. Towards the end of my career, I was working at the White House, and I had actually saw the Army Software Factory stand up, and I had reached out because I was hoping to recruit some more soldiers to come work at the White House. And I was happy that the Army was looking at, you know, software development in uniform, because the White House has a certain allotment of soldiers basically that I can work there. And my shop was basically filled out with mostly Air Force folks, because they do have a software development capability. I kind of joke about it that, you know, I was trying to recruit people from the Army Software Factory and they ended up recruiting me, but I was about to retire from the Army. That was my last job in the Army. So when I got out, this offer came down and my wife was excited to move to Austin, Texas. So found my way here.
Nice city. Yeah. I think Jeff.
Yeah. So my name's Jeff Day. I'm the chief of platform at the Army Software Factory. And Matt mentioned, you know, the software development capability that we're trying to describe back to the Army, the need and kind of the gap that we see there. And so that kind of breaks down into a number of different areas: software development, product management, product design, and then platform engineering. And so I get to work with a whole crew of beautiful soldiers that are doing absolutely amazing work in the platform engineering space on a daily basis. You know, my background is I really got my start also enlisted in the Army. Found Python. Worked my way through Python the hard way, all the glory days, and was of course back then as a junior enlisted, you don't make a lot of money. So there was this beautiful world that I could access for free, right? We're very low cost, and so that really got me started on into the software development space. And so I decided to go to school and then have had a number of jobs since then, but anywhere from cybersecurity into different engineering leadership roles across the Department of the Army. and a little time in private sector. So that journey, kind of seeing the different aspects of the software development lifecycle, the need for testing, the need for cybersecurity, the need for a process that enables rapid delivery, along with key influences, like we were talking before, of Mr. Farley himself and others, have really helped shape kind of how I see the world and the need for improving how we deliver software frequently.
So as we were talking before we started recording, you were mentioning that you'd had some background in kind of DevOps and continuous delivery style approaches to software development. So presumably that your influence and Matthew as well, that's influenced the way in which the Army Software Factory is taking shape.
Yeah, I would say absolutely. Like, for what it's worth, and I think between Matt and I, we'll be able to describe a process that's pretty good for you. So the way that the application teams and platform teams work, along with security and others at the software factory, is heavily influenced by, you know, lean, XP, and that DevOps mantra. And so we focus heavily on having pipelines, continuous integration that do matriculate through to continuous delivery, borderline continuous deployment at times, where they have application teams that commit code. It goes through a process that is trusted and sets the definition for what is deployable. Completing that process successfully results in a deployment. We do that very frequently, anywhere from a daily or faster at times, for software that's been around a little bit longer and maybe isn't getting as active attention for new features or that kind of thing, maybe weekly or a little bit longer for updates to get out. But in general, we try to follow as closely as we can the modern continuous delivery process for software development.
So you were talking about that. So it sounds like you've got some legacy as well as doing new things with what you're doing. So you've got both of those challenges a little bit.
Please go ahead, Matt.
No. I would not say we have anything like really legacy or brownfield. Okay. We've been asked to consult on some like other Army applications that are legacy or brownfield. And we've been around for about 5 years. So some of our oldest stuff is still on production. But it was all built under basically the same paradigm. So I wouldn't really call what we own as anything legacy.
Yeah, understand. So the people that are coming in and doing this, as you described, do you prefer Matt or Matthew?
I go by Matt.
Okay, Matt, thank you. I'll call you Matt if that's okay with you. So the way that you were speaking earlier, Matt, what it sounded to me is that pretty much exclusively the job here is to bring soldiers in as the developers. So mostly do those people come from a previous life where they have some background in this, or are you taking people and you're growing them into software developers, from scratch?
It's a little bit of the former and a little bit of the latter. So the Army didn't have a true software development like career, but it did have a lot of, like I said before, like IT related jobs, cyber related jobs, and there's a lot of overlap in the people in those jobs and the people who apply to come to the software factory. But it's not 100%. We've had people that are in other jobs like aviation or medical or mechanics or whatever. They often seem to have some type of an interest in software development, either before the Army or after they joined, they nurtured that interest and then this opportunity came along. Something interesting about the application process, where the Army has all these career fields, and we really can't just take a bunch of people from like the IT career field. Like we can't deplete those to build this new capability. So we have to kind of be that balance where we're pulling all these folks from. And so somebody who is maybe not necessarily IT background, they have a slightly, I would say, higher chance, you know, depending on the application period of getting selected just because of the way that balance ends up working.
Well, and I don't know whether this is a sensible question to ask or not, but that suggests to me that you might have some kind of interesting selection criteria to choose these people to figure out who's likely to be a good fit, who's likely to work out well. Is there anything that you can talk about that? I understand there are some things that we won't be able to talk about. Just say if at any point we touch on any of those, but
yeah. No, I don't think anything about our selection criteria is per se off the table. It's a fairly long process. The Army looks at the Army Software Factory as basically like a broadening assignment. Like it's managed like that right now. So broadening assignment, you know, basically means like it's a spot to do something in your career that's maybe like interesting to you, but not necessarily a core part of what your normal job is.
Yeah.
So we put out a message Army wide to at least to the people who are able to apply due to, you know, a bunch of different criteria about where they are in their career. And they, if they're interested, they also submit an application. There's a resume review period. So we have a group of folks who have come to kind of understand what makes a successful kind of tour through the Army Software Factory. And they look at, you know, indicators on the resume, and that gets through the first part. So we go from about 200 to 300 applicants down to about 100 there. And then they'll do interviews with folks, and there's a coding aspect to it. You know, hey, you know, how would you go about solving this? Some pseudo code, some actual coding. And there's also kind of a personality fit, you know, aspect to the interviews. And once we have an order of merit list produced, then we'll go into what's basically a negotiation phase with the different parts of the Army that own these people, and say, hey, you know, we'd like to have this person join our program for, you know, the next 2 years. Every person's kind of application is a unique story to them and their career. But we get down to 25 folks every 6 months. So that's what makes up a cohort.
Cool. And do all of the people coming into one of these cohorts have some knowledge of coding, or are you taking people and you teaching them coding as well?
We do teach them coding. Some definitely come in, but not all. It's not a prerequisite.
So the thing that's going through my head is that I can imagine viewers from, you know, a business context thinking, you know, we spend all of our time trying to recruit people with 5 years experience and all this kind of thing. And you guys are taking people with, in some cases, little or no coding experience, and then you're getting them up to speed. So how have you found that? What are the challenges of that being? Because I confess, I'm kind of with you. I think that software, the growth of software developers works better as sort of an apprenticeship style thing than it does as an academic discipline. But I think that's one of my heresies. So where do you stand, Doc?
Look, I think for what it's worth, I think it's absolutely fantastic, and some of the best results in terms of repeatable growth for these guys that I've ever seen in my career, and thankful for it. So generally the high level is they'll come in, they'll go through kind of a boot camp like experience in association with a university here in Austin, Austin Community College. And so depending on what they're coming in as, platform engineer or software development, right, they'll go through a period of time where they are learning kind of the foundational concepts of whichever skill they're developing. They'll step into what we've called a bridge program from there, where kind of the realities of what teams are working on, like on the floor at any given time, are kind of brought into this bridge program along to meet the engineers along with that academic portion. So they start to see, okay, this is the thing that I learned and how it's being applied today. So kind of a practical bridging program. And then they go out onto what we call the floor or the factory floor, and they join a team. What's really awesome is that when they join a team, it's paired programming, really, for platform engineering, software development all the way through. So they're paired with an industry expert for 6 months to a year. And then just kind of from there, more senior folks on the teams will pair with them.
Yeah.
And so as those cohorts kind of rotate over every 6 months, right, you're getting an opportunity to go through kind of that experience of being a junior dev to now kind of a mid dev, where you're able to contribute and you're working more evenly as part of a pair. And then at some point you're going to get a turn as being the senior member in a paired relationship, right?
I'm really pleased that you mentioned that about pair programming, because my view is that is the best way of bringing people and getting them up to speed. It's just such a fantastic way of people learning.
Yeah. I think that it really enables the work that we're doing here at Software Factory and trying to talk about software development as a capability for the Army, right? Like that's a moving target right now. There's a lot of change happening in the industry all the time. And through that kind of paired programming experience, we can stay focused, on high level. Hey, this is what the capability can do. But from the technologies that we're utilizing, we don't have to be super religious about an individual tech stack. Right now, our platform, for example, is a Kubernetes-based platform. So everyone, platform engineers, get the opportunity to learn Kubernetes and how to help software deploy and be hosted on a Kubernetes-based platform, right?
Yeah.
If we ever needed to change out how we're working, whether it's the platform or whether it's the tools and programming language for the application team, where we have a paired programming paradigm, so we can switch those out relatively easily in the sense that, we're going to have kind of a built-in method for upskilling or bringing everyone else along on those technical changes.
Yeah. So one of the things that we haven't really talked about yet, and, once again, I completely understand if some of this stuff you can't talk about, but the nature of the software that you're building, what kinds of systems are you creating and what kinds of problems are you solving? And you've already said, Jeff, that this is kind of a moving feast and it's changing all of the time. Completely understand. But just paint a picture. So we've got, even if you're not talking about real systems, but the kind of systems that you're building. So we've got a bit of a mental model of what that's like, would be great.
Yeah. So there are lots of examples. We built a bunch of apps already, and I'll give some examples. So we've got an application called Blast Radius, and it's designed to plan ammo handling points. So when your army goes somewhere, we put all the ammo in kind of a consolidated place, and there's lots of rules about where that place could be, how the ammo has to be stored. And a lot of those rules are kind of ripe for automation. In the past, before the app, a lot of folks would kind of handle this manually. They would have spreadsheets with different rules and calculations built in, but it was a little error prone. And it could lead to pretty bad results, kind of worst case scenarios. So it was ripe for automation and centralization. That's now basically a web app that folks can go to. They log in through a centralized Army login service that was already available. And then they can plan their ammo handling sites a lot more quickly. It's actually taught in the schoolhouse now for the folks that do that job, from basically how to use this app. They still have to learn the manual process and the reasons behind the rules.
Yeah.
But it does make the job easier for them in a lot of ways.
That one in particular, is that the kind of tool that you would use in the field?
So it is the kind of tool that we would use in the field. So that the Army has to move around a lot, and those ammo handling points need to be picked up and moved and replanned. So there's like distances from you know, like inhabited spaces that need to be calculated, stuff like that. There's also more tactical applications where like the soldiers have devices on them these days that like kind of share their location on a map and let them chat with others. We build plugins for those devices so that they can, you know, send like pretty formatted reports and consolidate that information instead of just kind of sending all their information free text. So it speeds up like situational awareness on the battlefield. But we do build stuff that I would say is more like on the other end of that, like those are tactical, I guess. But there's problems that you know, organizations have. The Army's a large, you know, bureaucracy, and then the subcommands under it are still pretty large, pretty unwieldy. And they have a lot of like manual processes that are also ripe for some type of automation. And those are definitely things that we do. We've built an app that tracks it jump status for folks. So the Army has an airborne set of people who jump out of the planes with parachutes, and there's a lot of safety regulations around that. Like they need to get so many jumps in a certain amount of time. They need to have training. And there's just a whole lot of planning, like logistical planning that goes into that. It also affects soldiers' pay. Like if they're on jump status, they get paid more. So we've written an app that allows that to be centralized, centrally managed. And, you know, as a former airborne soldier myself who, you know, tracked all this on paper, like I can tell you I've had to recreate my jump log from scratch. So seeing this finally be automated was you know, kind of soothing to me.
It scratches your own itch. Always the best.
You got any favorite apps, Jeff, you want to talk about or anything like that?
I think one of the cool things about the Army Software Factory, right? It's talked about that kind of in other places, right? We'd say, hey, you're a shop of a certain programming language, whether it's Java, .NET, or something else. And here in this organization, the leadership team and the application teams, everyone in general, really have a hyper focus on delivering outcomes in a way that is absolutely refreshing. In the sense that we accept kind of a challenge really at one point in time for developing an app that helps soldiers and their families find a way on post, and it was called My Army Post, and was out. So we designed it as a mobile application, and it ended up, you know, being implemented very quickly. We followed the normal design process of being iterative and working with end users and trying to design something that really worked for these families. And I think we nailed it. But the cool thing was we didn't adhere necessarily to our own tech stack in-house that we had at the time. We said, what's going to work best to solve this problem? And that's what we delivered. So I'm particularly proud of that effort. It was a great team that put it together. And I think it goes down as one of my favorites for sure.
Very cool. So how, what would you see as the kind of particular challenges that are different for you than for, you know, people building software for you know, business or as a product?
So I would say that working within the greater Army construct or the DoD construct, I know laws are applicable to everybody, but there's so many layers of law and policy that are like directly applicable to what we do. Navigating those takes a lot of know-how. I hate to refer to myself or some of my folks as bureaucrats, but in a way, being expert bureaucrats ever having access to them is part of what enables us to kind of do what we do. There's a huge side of the Army that cares about acquisitions. You know, for example, and acquisitions deals with hardware and software, and it kind of tends to see both of them combined together a lot of times. It also thinks about the long-term sustainment of things, and it can be a fairly unwieldy process. At the very least, a lot of times we can't step on what they're already doing. So if the Army is already paying somebody to solve a problem, the Army then can't like go and solve that problem out of hide, you know, for various reasons. But we do work around the edges, I would say, with existing acquisitions programs and stuff like that. We use some of their APIs and, you know, to both give and receive data. And we've worked with their teams coordinated. I don't think we've had any like major co-development efforts on enterprise software, but they are interested in some of the efforts like the airborne program that we wrote. Like they link to it from one of their like main personnel management systems. Another big one is kind of the cyber bureaucracy. If acquisitions is one side of that, like there's a whole separate side that is kind of like how the DoD manages cyber risk. And you know, we have, you know, great lawyers on the acquisition side, but we also have a great CISO on the cyber side that really helps. I like to say that the currency of this domain is trust. Like the people with authority to allow us to do what we do, they really have to trust that we're going to implement our processes and basically keep them protected. We're not taking undue risk. We're implementing the most security that we reasonably can in order to achieve the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. So working inside of both of those, bringing people up to like a common level of understanding about what we're trying to achieve and why it's necessary, you know, that can be a big challenge.
I think that touches on an interesting point, because I think lots of people outside of the military would imagine it being quite a bureaucratic kind of, you know, rules-led organization. And yet the approach to software development that you've adopted, at least the way that I think about it, as far as I understand what you're doing, isn't really like that. You know, we talk about small autonomous teams and working iteratively and all of those kinds of things. How do you manage that tension? Is there a tension? And if there is, how do you manage it? Why did you go that route rather than some more bureaucratic route? I'm trying to put words into your mouth now, because what I'm trying to get you to say is because it works better, but it's I'm really genuinely interested in your view on this.
No, so it works better is right. Like I, as you started asking your question, I was going to kind of fall back on the needs of the current environment. Like in order for an Army to really exist in these days of competition with you know, peer or near peer adversaries like China and Russia, like they don't constrain themselves, or at least we have to assume that they don't, you know, through bureaucracy. And to the greatest extent possible, we need to. But I am going to say, like it's not like we threw the rule book out the window either. We definitely work with like closely with our cyber kings. We're not doing anything that is illegal or immoral or even in the gray area, I would say. You know, I tell folks we practice kind of a golden path production style model where our tech stack doesn't change a lot between apps. And so we have this kind of core path where like, hey, we've got all these tools available to our developers, and they're pretty robust. As long as the security posture of an app doesn't change, like it can quickly get to production. And it doesn't increase our risk profile. It's when we want to introduce a new tool, the app team that needs it first is kind of undertaking that. And there is a burden placed upon them, but they take on that burden for the benefit of the entire factory. So once that thing is approved, now that, you know, dependency or tool or license or whatever it was, like, it's available to every other app team to use, and there's a set of guidelines for using it. So the next team that uses it will not have to take it on and can deploy quickly again.
So forgive me putting words into your mouth, but I'd interpret that as kind of, you know, an organic approach to reuse. People are solving real problems that they have, but with an eye on the prize of making sure that their solution is broadly applicable for other people too.
Yeah, I would say that that's a true statement.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. It's fascinating. And the way that you describe that, I think that one of the profitable avenues for explanation is maybe we could imagine taking an idea, you know, through the process. What does the development process actually look like? So how do you organize, and how do teams do the real work?
You want to talk about that one, Jeff?
I'll give it a shot. You jump in if I'm getting crazy over here. So I guess kind of backing up a little bit, right? There's usually this kind of problem or scoping statement that occurs, right? We have identified a problem somewhere in the Army that is worthwhile to solve, right? So it kind of forms a hypothesis, and like there is still validation required of the hypothesis and the value being deliverable and so on. But basically there's this concept of what we're trying to do and what value we believe it's going to bring loosely to the table. And that team will pick up that problem statement and start trying to work with it, right? They'll coordinate with a set of stakeholders. They'll start identifying users and target personas and so on to try and make sure that what's being built is as closely aligned to what we believe will provide value as possible. And then, of course, the iterative development, making sure that it is actually providing the value that we think it's going to provide. The app team themselves are typically comprised of a product manager, a product designer, and then anywhere from 4 to 6 software engineers. And so supporting those guys is a couple of teams of platform engineers working on the platform. And of course, we have security personnel as well. And then we've got a data office and others that really support and enable the delivery of that software. So as the developers, right, so the product manager being largely focused on the business case, the designer trying to help with UI UX, understand and communicate customer need, and then the engineers trying to support from, hey, what's the realm of possible from a technical perspective, and then and beginning implementation, they'll start typically by utilizing what we call a starter app. So kind of all that boilerplate stuff to just get a project off the ground that you're either using ChatGPT for these days or trying to copy paste from a different project, right? Because no one likes doing the boilerplate. So we have a starter app that kind of pulls in some of that baseline security that Matt was mentioning earlier, and also helps with just the structure of the software application, getting it off the ground.
Years and years ago, I used to work for a consultancy called ThoughtWorks, and we started a project that we called Project in a Box, so that we could, in those days, it was a CD. So you could turn up at a client with a CD that had all a basic project to starting point, that all of that template stuff. Yeah,
that's exactly it, right? You just feel like if you go out to GitHub or whatever, and you like, I like writing Golang code, so I'll go find Go start or app, whatever, for whatever use case, and just to help accelerate things. And so we have kind of naturally adopted organically, as you were saying earlier, adopted some of these kind of structures to help accelerate that first commit and then and first push into production.
Yeah.
We do take seriously here test-driven development. And so the engineers in that paired programming paradigm that we have will begin developing a feature, or they'll follow TDD practices as they're doing it, and then it'll continue to matriculate. They might do a journey test, but those can kind of be built in as they go.
right? And then a commit push to the pipeline, where that is where we'll have the definition of what's deployable, right? Matt was mentioning coordinating those rules that we have to follow. So we do everything that we can to try and codify those rules, providing an interface to these app teams of what's releasable, and answering that question without the need for a lot of manual review, although there is some for an initial push.
Yeah.
And then from there, right, you go through your normal kind of validation process, right? SAS, DAST, and other security scans.
Yeah.
Do rerun unit testing and compile and build and so on until you get to a deliverable deployment. And then the whole point is to go through that process again and again and again as fast as you can to make sure you with end users and their needs.
So talking about as fast as you can, what kind of cycle times do you have in your pipelines and from the point at which I commit a change, how long before I know that it's releasable?
Yeah. So that's a great question, Dave. So right now, I think we are averaging about 20 minutes, which is a little high, honestly, for a pipeline run. There's been a lot of, right? So I would say it's a place I know we need to improve without a doubt. If we can, and the teams do as well. There are kind of some things that we're trying to take care of as we go into and build out kind of a new area for development. And one of the things on the hit list is trying to improve cycle time. What I think is, I think we're finding a good balance though, because that 20-ish average of cycle time is not entirely on necessarily like the platform team or the security team with that validation portion of the pipeline. We do have an idempotent or a pipeline that does set the standard for what's deployable, but you can, right, just quickly, if you developed using Vercel or any other type of platform as a service from industry, right, the developers are able to take some actions before it goes into that validation step. And that contributes to the overall cycle time, right? So some teams will have more journey testing, which takes more time to run. Yep. Some teams will have less or less complexity that they're dealing with. Maybe they're just getting started with their app, and so they'll have a lower cycle time, of course. And we'll see anywhere. I think it's roughly 8 minutes, and then it gets up to about 25 minutes or so. So as apps kind of are built out. So there's still the 25 minutes we would love to get after, reducing it, getting closer to, 15 minutes or less, kind of as a rough north star.
I guarantee you, if there's anybody listening to this, they're going to be envious of your 25 minutes. As what one of the things that always seems very evident to me that are doing well, for teams that are doing well at continuous delivery, is that they always want more. They always want to go faster. They always want shorter, tighter feedback cycles. And that's the right thing to want. It's the right mindset, is that continuous improvement thing. But it's nice to hear you make it so clearly.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Matt.
No, please.
No, I'd just say that, like, I think, right, there's, like I mentioned before, and it can kind of sound cliche, like being very focused on outcome delivery, right? A lot of people can say that, but, and I said it was refreshing, the focus that we have on outcome delivery here at Software Factory, because I mean that truthfully. But part of that focus, right, if delivery is getting an app team's change into production, right, and we have this heavy focus on getting value delivered, those improvements to the process app teams have to go through to deliver is critical. And so it really helps hyper-focus, not just the app teams, but also everyone that's built, kind of around them to help to support them on getting value delivered. And so we do pursue it aggressively. We try, to do what we can to track how long individual pipelines are taking to run, if there's instability in the pipeline, or if there's an instability somewhere else in the platform. Right, like we'll prioritize those and seek improvement. We have a very much kind of across the organization a learning perspective as we're doing this. So, we'll have new folks come in; they'll bring new ideas, and it's easy to bring up and share new ideas or process or technology, because everyone's on a perspective of, hey, we did a thing because we thought it was the right thing to do at a time. And then we've learned, oh, this was a trade-off we didn't expect, or this didn't go as well as we expected, or it went great. We should continue. So that cycle of learning is happening both with the app team and the platform teams when it comes to that continuous improvement approach for the pipelines and the process to get apps delivered.
Yeah. So the other thing that you said in there that strikes me as being very important is that the development teams have ownership of their own work. So if they need to tweak the deployment pipeline because they've got some special needs, that's okay. That they're not kind of forced into a pigeonhole with somebody else outside the team making decisions that force them in a certain direction. Is that a fair take on what you said?
I would agree with that as much as we can. So I would say, like, the goal is to empower each individual team, giving them a product context and give them a problem that, you know, we're trying to solve, and then try and guide and mentor them, if anything, towards a good solution. Really try and help the individual team pursue and deliver on a problem, whether that's an app team or a platform team. It's the same approach. I would try and characterize it as me working collaboratively with these teams to try and work together to find the best possible solution at any given time. And there are absolute times where the PMs and the teams themselves who own a product context will say, hey, we think this is a bad idea, right? And that's okay. It's good. Like, I'm thankful that they would call something like that out and know that there's a time to adjust. So just because any one person, myself included in that, has an idea doesn't mean it's the best idea. I might throw something out there as here's a starting point. Who's got a better idea, right? And keep moving from there.
Yeah, and as we were talking about before, having fast feedback so you can discover the ideas that aren't good enough quickly.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, did you want to add anything onto that, Matt?
Yeah, the way I characterize our pipeline in my mind, you know, first, I would say I normally tell people there are kind of three owner parties in the mix. Well, one of them being the platform team, kind of setting the standards for delivery and into production and staging. One of them being the security team, it kind of setting the standards for those different scans. And then the app team setting the standards for their testing. And together, that's what makes a successful pipeline. And there are a lot of examples for them to copy off of, you know, basically, because we've gotten several apps to production by this point.
Yeah.
But it's not to say that the previous standards are the only standards either. But when you do kind of overlap or you want to make a change, the teams can't like exempt themselves from the security requirements before getting to production. For example, and sometimes they are impacted by things in the platform, like you know, CVEs and container images or something that they can't directly do anything about. So they need to rely on the platform team to help them.
Yeah.
Another thing I was going to bring up is the 20 minute timeline. I recognize that it is good, and people would be happy with that if they're coming from, you know, a worse pipeline. Yeah. But it's still in that time frame of like hey, people are gonna walk away and do something else. You know, I'm not gonna sit and wait 20 minutes, 25 minutes for my pipeline to run. And that is a major break, because a lot of times that 20 to 30 minutes is going to become an hour or two before, you know, I get my results, my feedback. And if it's not what I expected, then I feel like it's a major setback, that kind of thing. So there's definitely like we've gotten faster, but there's a lot of room to improve there.
Yeah. Do you differentiate between running faster tests and slower tests in the pipeline? Do you do the staging thing in the pipeline, or do you just treat it all as one?
So it is all as one. The tests, again, belong really to the app team. Like, so they, if they don't have, you know, a journey test or they might, some teams do journey tests offline instead of incorporating it into their pipeline. They really are the owners there. We do have and I almost hate to say it, but code coverage requirements for tests. Not because Jeff or I necessarily wanted them, but because we're already meeting them anyway, and it makes other people feel good, basically. So there is that requirement, and the unit tests do have to be basically in pipeline.
I'm not a big fan of coverage as a target, but it's a very useful technical marketing tool. I don't disagree.
That is how I view it. So
it's
only so far you can bring people. I would say before they start to, to be fair to some of the cyber folks that might listen to this or whatever, like they're normally inundated with requests to approve things.
Yeah.
And when the things look wildly different from one another, like they try and find, metrics. Like, I know that was good. And they implemented a code coverage requirement. Like, it makes sense to be able to see those same artifacts from different teams.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked a little bit about the requirements process at the start. We've talked a little bit about the pipeline and testing strategies. What about into production? So the impression that I got is that most of the apps that you've talked about are kind of software as a service kind of things. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. So are you running those in the cloud? Is this, have you got that set of problems? Are you doing things with observability? Are you doing canary releasing or any of those sorts of release strategies? How does that go?
Some yeses, some noes in there. We're primarily in AWS GovCloud.
Yeah.
So we're inside what is commonly called the DODIN, the DoD Information Network. I want to say that. So there's a big firewall, and then the Army has got its own firewalls inside of that. So we sit behind all of them. We're inside this big network. It makes it easier to maybe release to Army clients kind of on we call it NIPRNet, but there's it's basically a I'm losing the word here, but
the intranet.
Yeah, intranet. Yeah, exactly. Like for Army or for DoD. Yeah. And when we want to release a commercially available app, like it still sits inside of that same environment, but we have to do the tickets to the folks who own these different firewalls, basically like in reverse order, all the way outside to the commercial environment to allow it to be broadly available on the internet. You asked about canary releases. We haven't done anything like that. Not because we can't. I think our apps have largely been targeted and kind of small, at least at MVP. It's still not the reason not to do it, I guess. It might be because we're not too terribly experienced either. Like our app teams are, mostly comprised of junior to intermediate, with maybe one or two experienced devs, and the scope of the problem, that kind of thing. It hasn't really necessitated it to date.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think I lost some of the question in there. Did I?
No. I think it's interesting. So it's a relatively straightforward cloud deployment, and you've got the protections of working within the Army's intranet.
Right.
What? We guys summon this in there, right? I mentioned we're on a Kubernetes-based platform, so as apps roll out, it's a rolling update. Because the cycle time is as fast as it is, you need to improve that, right? We have the ability to roll forward if there is a problem that we discover, right? We can technically also roll back as well, and have in the past when needed. We do monitor on the platform for the pods, for example, coming up and being in a healthy state. We are, I would say, doing some some baseline observability in terms of like the health of the platform, although that's another, frankly, we are looking to improve over the next year as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons for that, kind of the state that we're in, but the point is that we have some of the basics there, I think, but yes, there's plenty of room to improve as we start to move forward too. And I think we've got a good set of folks to make that happen. But yeah, so we have some of those advantages. We're in the cloud, and that does ease the deployment process in and of itself. Of course, we're not talking about, you know, systems distributed globally or anything like that.
Yeah.
But there is some support there. We have looked at kind of the need for either, you know, green, blue or canary or other type of deployment paradigms.
Yeah.
But frankly, like as Matt was saying earlier, right, doing that work needs to be valuable enough to be prioritized at a level. We're not seeing the change failure rate that would indicate that needs to be escalated in priority any higher than it is, but more as a pursuit option or a thing to have on backlogs and in mind.
Yeah, that seems like a very sane, pragmatic way of making those sorts of decisions to me. I mean, you know, there's no purity check that you must be doing all of these things. It's what works is that what really matters.
That's right.
So what are the challenges? What it all sounds like it's working pretty nicely. So what are the hard parts?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about the greater bureaucracy hard part. So
yeah.
I would say there's recruiting in general. You got to constantly stay on top of keeping your name out there so that people continue to know that this is an opportunity in the Army to pursue. There are a lot of just like there are regular problems, the everyday problems of having an organization. I would say that the size we are, there's a demand and our ability to meet it. So on the one hand, we accept problem submissions from across the Army. And when we choose not to pursue a problem, some people, folks are, you know, they feel a way about that. Like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was. So, but we need to be really selective about the things we choose to jump in on, both for, you know, the already, you know, stated legal or cyber reasons, but also, you know, because we saw it or we didn't think we could affect a problem, or we would have needed a new technology that we just don't have yet or can't afford. We do have a budget. We're about a 150 to 200 people organization that includes some staff. So all of that is it's just resourcing constraints. I would say I don't want to classify them as problems, but figuring out where the best investments are. I don't want to say we have any real big problems. We did move from being a 3-year program down to a 2-year program, because there's a lot of demand from units across the Army to have soldiers trained in software development. And that demand, I think it reduces the quality of the soldiers we output, basically. A year of experience is important. Removing that, it doesn't make the soldiers, you know, bad or incapable of fulfilling the needs of these units that they go to. But it does mean that there's just less experience informing their decisions. They're going to get it now, like kind of in the field instead of within the guardrails that we've kind of set in place at the software factory.
Yeah.
Those are meeting the need meeting the demand for the soldiers while keeping quality high. That's another balance that's hard to strike.
It's interesting that the things that you see as problems none of them are really software related. They're organization related. And, you know, you've got the software development part, with lots, you know, most organizations find difficult. That seems to be working pretty well, which is a nice place to be. You can't avoid the other kinds of problems in a big organization, it seems to me, but they're you know, endemic in any big organization. And no doubt that, you know, the military's, you know, has its own flavor of those things. But it's interesting that the way that you were describing that, I thought.
Yeah. I would say like if I'm trying to think about software problems, you know, we don't, the Army likes to build to requirements a lot of times, like, hey, you know, I've got specifications for an app. We don't build that way. You know, and it part of that is it because we get to choose and own the problems that we're developing against. We like to tell folks like we're proud of the fact that nobody has to use our apps. Like the users that come because we're genuinely helping them do something. None of these are Army required, you know, top down driven. You know, but that said, like when parts of a major problem are owned by another organization, it can drive like I guess it's still a you know, not a software problem. I don't know, it has an effect on the software, obviously.
It definitely has an effect on the software. Yeah.
Yeah. I do want to say we don't have a true, like, you know, a software problem in the traditional sense. I would say the biggest thing is probably being held back by Golden Pass. You know, the pass is always so wide. There are probably problems we don't take on because, you know, we couldn't come up to speed on a different tech stack, you know, a completely different thing quick enough. Yeah. We haven't done a lot of kind of, Jeff mentioned My Army Post earlier, but a lot of native apps. That one was at the direction of the chief of staff of the Army. So with enough senior leader backing, like it gets you kind of out over some of those things, but that was an unusual tech stack for us. And it's not something we would just pick up and do if we didn't have like senior leader backing.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds very good. And you know, it doesn't surprise me that it's working because it's, you're doing the things that I would expect that you need to do to make these things work. But it's great to hear that it's working in your circumstances and with some unusual constraints or differences, maybe is a better word, not really constraints. But I love the fact that you're taking people without necessarily a strong IT background and bringing them into this, and that's working, and that's a great validation of techniques like pair programming, test-driven development, and so on, to my mind, because I do think those are great tools for doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, we take great pride in having soldiers of different diverse backgrounds doing this work, and it's affected our ability to do well too. Like we think that some of our apps are more successful because we have developers that have direct experience in the fields that they're working. Not to say that we let them, you know, kind of replace themselves as the customer of the app, but I think good apps are built when you really understand the problem you're trying to solve.
100%, absolutely. I think I one of the phrases that I've started using is that our job is not to write code, it's to solve problems for people. And in order to be able to do that, you've got to understand the problem. And it, as we were talking earlier about scratching your own itches, but you know, if it's a problem that you've suffered from, then you're going to have a different kind of insight. That's definitely a true statement, I think. We kind of come into the end of our time, I think, and I want to thank you both for being so generous with your time and telling us your story, because it's fascinating and really positive. I think it's really great that this is working so well in an important cause. So thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.